So, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to begin if you guys are all ready. So if you want to take your first wine and pour it in a glass, welcome to the first Liquid Storyteller event of 2025. Once again, happy to have you here as your host, along with the Sillies and the ever amazing Rachel Lippman by my side here to talk a little about some grapes that we think are completely off the radar for a lot of people, but stuff that I don't want to say we just geeked out on, because there's a lot more than just finding some odd, obscure grape that just nobody knows. The wines that we have for you today all tell amazing stories. Some of them were popular once and are coming back, but a majority of them are just things that we've tried and we just wish everybody loved them the way that we've glommed onto them, because not just of this incredible story of how they came to be in your glass, but because of the fact that these grapes all show something amazing, and most of them are tied into even bigger stories. And that's one of the best parts about my job, is getting to meet these families and try these wines and then hear everything that they're doing. And my goal more than anything else is to just be a good steward for their stories and try to explain all the hard work they did. And sorry, we're going to make that go. Boom. Is everybody okay with that? more than anything else, one of the most exciting things that's happening in the world of wine is we realize that, you know, we can't just continue on the way we were. Whether you want to talk about some of the new health reports about what you're doing in wine, some of the new trends about what everybody's drinking, or just the fact that old school commercial farming just isn't going to cut it. And again, that whole idea of terroir that the French have had forever and ever and ever, that we're making wine and what we're growing here and what we're doing here is this combination of my beliefs as far as a winemaker, our philosophy as far as a house, and then also the soil and the grapes that we're using. There is nobody on the planet, I think, that I want more people to get to know than the producers of our first wine, Selva Capuzza. Selva Capuzza is in Lugano, in the Lake Country of Italy. It's quite ridiculously beautiful up there. And they have the Alps to one side, this amazing lake in front of them, and they're up on a small plateau, creating this great, unique microclimate. And they're dedicated to only doing the local grapes that are grown there. So they're definitely not trying to impress anybody else. They know it's a big tourist destination, so people are going to come there. So why do we have to try to be something else? You're coming to see us, so if you want to drink with us, come and drink with us. The wine that's in your glass is a cousin of Trebbiano. It's actually called Turbiano, and it's made in the Martinotti method, which is the Italian way of making sparkling wine, in the Charmat method, where you're basically taking your juice, you're going to press that, put it in a tank, and it's going to start its first fermentation, and then you're going to add more yeast and more sugar and start a second fermentation. And then we're going to let that carry over and we're going to bottle that. And that's where it's going to get all its power. So this is one of the seven main ways of making sparkling wine. And one of the ones that was really a little bit revolutionary in the sense that, you know, here, instead of just having to do individual bottle by bottle, where there's some variation in method ancestral and the Petnat method, and then there's the old Blanquette de Limo, the champagne way, method original or method champenois, this was a way to do large quantities of it. You can also do large quantities in the soda method, where you're just charging it and doing that. But this has more character, more body. So this is the reason why, when Prosecco was first shining, it was their use of the Charmat method that really pushed it forward. So this was the wine that I fell in love with this winery. They also do a still version, and then they do some Chiaretto and some other local grapes. They're on the site of an old historic battle. One of the, like, basically Italy's version of Antietam was here on this. And they also had a guy that was touring around that was a dignitary associated with Napoleon, who reported back on that. And this is the birthplace, basically, of the Red Cross, where it was started on this property, the whole idea of the Red Cross. So they do a bottle to commemorate that as well. So again, you've got all this history that's going on, and it's intriguing to me. But then we get to drink the wine. And once you drink the wine, let's have a little sip first, and then I'll tell you more about the name and everything else. The name of the wine is Horundo. And everybody thinks about it must be this Italian guy that went off to, like, Japan or Asia or somewhere and came up with it, but it's actually Latin. And it comes from Herondois, which is basically loosely translated from Latin as to swallow, because their property is on the migration line for the swallows. And so it is one of those things that they seem to follow the grapes, and when the grapes are ripe, they show up again. And then
swallows,
when they leave,
are not fun.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, Ray?
Yeah, swallows are the ones that will decimate a whole, like, crop. So they are not fun. They tend to, as everyone probably knows, if you see swallows anywhere, they're in very large, like, colonies, basically. And we see them, and they will decimate through an entire crop within like a week. Yeah. So not fun. There's some vineyards in Maryland that have started seeing them this year, or last year, I guess, technically. And it was like the first time ever they had to put up nets. And it was like a race. I mean, they had to order like miles worth of netting just to like cover, because you have to cover it on both sides, of course. Yeah. So not fun. But it's kind of interesting that... Yeah.
So their philosophy, they boldly state on their website and to anybody else in all their perspectives, we are not organic. But it's not in the sense of we don't believe in organic principles and everything else. They have been pesticide free for over 40 years. They don't do that. They've been practicing organic methods. But what they said is, look, we don't like this whole concept that people are doing organic because it's cool or because it's trendy and to move into biodynamic and everything else without actually understanding what you're doing. They went and actually tried to do some organic farming. And to them, they have this really unique area, a really unique microclimate, and this whole balance between the flora and the fauna that they have that makes this one of the most unique places. And to them, it's the soil, which most organic people will tell you. One of my favorite guys to ever talk about dirt, John Williams from Frog's Leap. He'll sit there and he'll wax poetic about how it looks like coffee grinds and hummus and it's got the right bug mixture and everything else in it. And you get that that's what it is, that these people go crazy because they want to say, if I can tell you how to make your dirt look like mine, you're going to be able to grow great stuff too. And that's what is really the secret to it. But it's a lot of work to get the dirt to be so fabulous, something that we don't think about. And when they were doing organic farming, they realized that by going through, first of all, we were compacting a lot of the soil that we have. They have a high level of clay in that soil. So when you're putting all that weight, you're pushing that down and pushing that down, and that makes your job a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, it suffocates in many aspects. So I think the really interesting thing is like the term organic really shouldn't mean very much to most people, in the sense that me personally, in terms of the term organic, it doesn't mean that you're actually spraying anything better. A lot of times it means you're spraying more elemental compounds, which are actually, in many aspects, worse for your health. Like if you're working in a vineyard and you're having to spray copper or sulfur, your health 50 years down the line is going to be much worse than if you were to be a conventional farmer in some aspects. I think organic has some misnomers in that realm. When it comes to being earth friendly, a lot of times people are buying new technology, and new technology is great and all, but you're spending it's not being earth friendly to something earth friendly. I mean, if you think about a lot of hybrid tractors that exist or hybrid cars that exist, you have the batteries. It takes a lot of effort to destroy a battery, more effort than a lot of times like the fossil fuels. So anyway, it's the compaction of the vineyard makes a big difference. There are some vineyards I worked with in France and that I know of that instead of using as many passes in a tractor, they'll use horses because it doesn't weigh as much and it's more hands-on. But there's a lot to say about that term organic. I think like we just read, he said eco-sustainable, which means that like you're more friendly toward earth and not just buying new things because you think they're cool and you think they're going to help. And if you have like 10 different tools that are like massive pieces of equipment, it's not actually any better. You have to think about like also the aspect that if you're using things year after year after year, and if they break, you fix them instead of buying new things. That's also being sustainable because you're not buying something new. You're reusing things. So there's the aspect of the eco-sustainable of what they're doing is like that speaks to a lot of what I grew up with doing. I mean, it's like it's beyond the bullshit, to be honest. Like, honestly.
No, it's true. And because, again, everybody likes shiny new toys and new tools. And here's a new trend and jump on that. But what these guys – so they rejected organic because – the soil that they have is super unique. It is heavy on clay, but then because this whole entire area was carved through by glaciers, they have these alluvial deposits and these amazing, amazing bands of significant rock that are in there with the clay, which prevents a lot of the compaction because you have this unbelievable amount of stone there. And then they have bands of gravel and sand. So imagine clay with big rocks for drainage and then gravel and sand underneath there. It is a dream.
That's like You can't get any better.
Yeah, it's perfect.
You really can't get. Yeah, I mean, you don't even want. There's no silt or loam, probably. I'm sure. Yeah, so like they're fine.
So to them, that's
I want to move there.
How do we protect this? I told you you're going to like them.
Yeah. It's...
How do we protect this? So they rejected organic because they said, look, when we went through and we did organic, we were in the vineyard 9 times more traveling back and forth. And so we're killing the grasses that are inviting the flora, the fauna, and the bees. We are killing the soil that we have that is so rich. And then, as Rachel pointed out, we're leaving behind 6 times more copper and hard metals by going through and doing this. So organic is not the right thing. What they've done is they've gone out, and when they want to fight the bugs and everything else, they're introducing the asexual bugs to create confusion in the bug population. So they don't know what to do, but they're still going to go and do their bug things, but they're just not going to reproduce. They have a lot of ladybugs. They've adopted the SQNIP technology, or the philosophy, which is the sustainable organic in practice. They've used every single part of their bottles are recycled glass, recycled paper. They cut the weight of their bottles by almost 1/3 based on other normal bottles. So this is one of those things where they said, look, you can talk about being green and you can talk about being organic and everything else, but what are you actually doing in your life?
Yeah.
So here we're going to do it. They built an entire green wall on one side of the building to help defray the energy and what it takes to heat and cool their whole cellar. It's stunning what they do. And their wines are beautiful. I love this bottle of bubbly because it doesn't drink to me like soft and weak Prosecco. And it also doesn't drink as super yeasty and you know, sometimes push that needle where people do and don't like champagne. To me, this is glorious. I would drink this with every meal and with almost everything that you could possibly put in front of me. And I would find it hard to turn down. So to me, I'd never had Turbiano, even all the years that I was drinking Italian wine until we met up with this winery. So it was an eye-opening thing for me. It's beautiful as a still wine. It's going to drink a little bit more like Chardonnay, but without the Chardonnay weight to it. Still super fresh, a great deep dark golden color to it. Their reds are stunning and fun. Their Chiaretto Rosé is a little bit more oomphy, more body to it as rosé. But I just can't get over this bottle. So that's why I wanted to throw this one at you guys.
It's pretty floral. I mean, I don't know if anyone picks up like the little muskiness. That's like, it's kind of like, it's kind of seductive in some aspects. And it has the floral you usually see in Prosecco, you know, but it's not floral and like potpourri. It's not floral and like being foxy or anything like that. It's floral in the sense it's more underlying, and it's Trebbiano is very interesting compared to this because Trebbiano is, I think, in many aspects, more Chardonnay like an un-oak Chardonnay, like that high acid. And then this one is a little bit more, it has more maturity to it. And from how
it is very much for me when I smell the wine, like walking through a field with wildflowers and grasses and everything else around there. It's a very inviting wine. Joni had a question for us. So there's a lot of confusion. So in the world of sparkling wine, there's different layers and levels to how both the sugar level and the level of sparkling love atmospheres in it. So your spumantes were often more so a designation for how sparkling they are. And then that most in America, we got that in conjunction with like Asti Spumanti, which was always a sweet frizzante bubbly. So the atmosphere, as far as pressures were between 1.5 and 2.6, if I remember correctly, atmospheres for those levels. Whereas these are usually going to be 3, 3.5 and above to get it to this level, which is the same level where you're going to find your sparkling wines. And then below that, you're going to have your slightly frizzante. Again, your pet nats are going to straddle that line in between because of the subjective nature of how pet nats manifest themselves. So again, the confusion being most of the time, it starts with the first problem with Asti, which Asti is always going to be when it's Asti Spumanti, they're talking about the sweeter stuff from Asti in the Piemonte. And then so without Asti there, just Spumanti is a level of the atmospheres of pressure and probably their residual sugar level, which is going to be, for the most part, I want to say most Spumantes are between 6 and 12. Brutes are 6 to 12. So
yeah,
those are
Spumante is like.
That's okay. I can look that up.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've done the Italian.
Yes, we'll talk about that. Okay. Selva Caputa, they do it just bottled under Lugano, because it's a little bit like the French idea of look. You come into our area, if we say Lugano white, you should know that it means we're probably talking Turbiano as the grape. But yeah, and it's going to run very similar in price. I want to say it's about $2 less a bottle
for the still one. We'll do that at one of the future ones, or at some point in time. We'll meet up for happy hour, and I'll say, hey, hi, grab Joni. I got a bottle of that. Yeah, I love it. Which leads me, does anybody have any other questions about bubbles or anything else? Am I moving too quick? Which leads me, speaking of favorite things, 1995, the first time I ever sipped Fazi Battaglia Verdicchio from Marche and Abruzzo, and I lost it. I thought, why am I ever going to drink Pinot Grigio again? I just moved to Arizona from New York. I had had a lot of bias for all the Finger Lakes wines, and they really, that's where I cut my teeth, and I had an appreciation for doing dry Riesling and Gewürztraminer and blends. And here I am at La Fontanella, an amazing restaurant on Camelback in Phoenix. And they said, tonight our chef has done a special that reminds him of home. It's artichokes a la Greca, which is just an artichoke split into three with herbs and olive oil and just thrown in just like that, barely cleaned and trimmed down and just thrown in so that you were literally, you're pulling it apart. And then we're like, how do you eat it? And they're like, oh, just like a chip, you know, put it in there and pull it off and then go on to the next little piece. And artichokes are traditionally one of those very difficult wines to pair with because of the way. But with that intensity of the richness and the olive oil and the herbs, the guy that was the wine steward recommended, if you haven't had Verdicchio, this would be perfect with that. And so we did, and that was it. I haven't gone back since. It's one of my all-time favorite grapes. Gambaro Rosso has said it's the single most important white grape to the future of Italian wine. So there's a lot of weight to put on that little grape, and there's a lot of great producers on there. But there's also these things that are just one step over. And that's what's going to be in your glass right now. This is Vignamato's Versus, which is Verdicchio, but it's a very special Verdicchio. It's a clone, and here's where it's going to start to be fun. Once upon a time in Italy, there's a guy named Bruno Bruni, and Bruno Bruni is an oenologist, and he's making grapes, and he crosses Verdicchio from his home area of Marche with Sauvignon Blanc. And he decides, I love this combination. It's so good. It's so tasty. It's so beautiful. And I'm going to name it Incrocio Bruni. So Bruno Bruni's grape is Incrocio Bruni from his winery, Bruno Bruni Winery. It just
so it, Italian.
It is so Italian and so wonderful. And, so and then you try it and you're going, wait a minute. This is very, very cool. Because you normally Verdicchio, you get all these green flavors. And it's got a different acid base than you're going to find out of Sauvignon Blanc. So when you bring in the high acid of Sauvignon Blanc, you're creating this wine that is this very clean, very fresh powerhouse that is just asking for all sorts of vegetables and salad and fish and go crazy with any of those things. It doesn't matter what you're going to pick. It doesn't matter how green it is. It doesn't matter the type of fish. You could just have it with this little wine.
I love this winery in general. I mean, I first, and I think, what was it, 2017 when we brought Vignamato in?
Yep.
This is so interesting from a winemaking perspective because it actually tastes like those two are co-fermented, but it actually is just one variety,
one grape.
Because like on the nose, you get a little bit of the guava, a little bit of that like citrusy characteristic. Verdicchio tends to have more of, well, it depends. Like Vignamato does a Verdicchio that's barrel aged, which right. is glorious. And it's a little bit more leasy, but it has, I think sometimes more body than the Sauvignon Blanc does. And I
sure.
think that that's where like that roundness kind
of
comes from.
Less of the tropical, more of your traditional
yeah,
citrus.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah. More of the traditional. Yeah. Like this is more like on the nose has more guava because of the Sauvignon Blanc aspect. Like that was crossed with it.
Which is what I love because I got to tell you, I was on board yeah. when New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc first came out as a complete left turn and alternative from your California kind of grassy herbal ones and your super vegetal French yeah. stony minerally ones. So it was a delight to be turned onto those, but it very quickly for me turned into, oh my God, it's the same thing as opening up a can of Del Monte fruit cocktail. There's just
yeah.
so much juicy True. Fruit and sugars and everything else yeah. in there. And it's very hard for me to call it wine. For my palate, it was more like a cocktail. I mean, we could throw, rarely tell everybody, you know, you should throw ice cubes in wine, but I rarely will be offended if you throw ice cubes in a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc because I get it. Because you're attempting to tame down some of that fruit by making it colder and less sweet.
Yeah.
It is one of those
that's
things.
That's why my mom loves it. Yeah. But she doesn't put it ice cubes, that she just anyway,
it's like a, it's almost frozen, like a cocktail. Basically. I mean, yeah. I expect at any moment somebody with a New Zealand accent to pop up and be like, "I'm really Bartles and James still, and I'm still here for
That's
your
where
wine."
My worst hangovers are from New Zealand, Sauvignon Blanc.
But it's not bad because yeah. they are beautiful. That idea of that tropical fruit, it's really inviting. And it's yeah. fun because your head, as a wine drinker, I love it. I smell it. And you're like, oh, that's like a ripe, one of those really orangey guavas that yeah. you get, you know, as opposed to some of the green papayas and mangoes.
This actually, for anyone who likes Rias Baixas from like Albarino, like this is entirely up their alley. Like if you like the Albarinos from Spain, because Spanish Albarinos tend to have like the minerality, they have the fruit, they have like the tropical notes. Sometimes they can go way tropical depending on where it's produced. But in this case, I think that the balance is actually achieved what you would expect in a really high quality Rias Baixas Albarino, but with this, and obviously Italian.
What do you think about the finish, though? Because I think it's with all that fruit up front, for me, I'm amazed at how subtly dry this wine gets.
Yeah, it doesn't. So it sounds weird, but like one of my best ways of putting it, when you're drinking something with really high acid, like Sauvignon Blanc, for example, when you drink a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, and this is just going to sound weird, and I'm just going to say it. Has anybody noticed that you get a film on the back of your throat? Like it's like eating really unripe pineapple, like where it's like really high acid. So your mouth is salivating to an extent where it has to overcome it. Maybe I'm the only person. My mom gets that. I mean, like people in my family get it because I've talked to them about it. Anyway, maybe not. But there is a physical response that your mouth gets from things that are really high acidity. And especially when it's sharp acidity that goes to the back of your palate and the back of your mouth. The thing that's really nice with this one is that it doesn't do that. Like I don't have that physical response. Yeah, I don't have that physical response that that's just like my body's kind of rejecting it, if that makes sense. It's a smooth finish. The acidity doesn't race all the way back. It dissipates really nicely where it's well balanced in that sense. You get the acidity up front in the front part of your mouth on the top gums and the bottom gums, but you don't get it racing in the back of your throat.
But it's there. I mean, it's so yeah. there. And what
do you
I
get
love
that
about,
film?
Yeah, I sometimes like it's like you eat a whole bag of Sour Patch Kids, and you're going,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you
okay.
Eat them because you've gotten to that point.
I was trying to think like maybe I'm crazy because like I'm not the only
with
one.
This one, it's so dry. So by the time you realize it's dry, you're going for another glass again or another yeah. bite of what you've had. So it's done what really good wines with really great acidity do. They dry, clean out, and refresh your whole entire palate so that you go back in. Like I just had another little piece of the cheese with yeah. this wine, and really. The first time I had the cheese, I mean, it's always delicious here, and it's really good feta. But then you have a little bit of wine, and then you have the cheese again, and that cheese is just screaming. You're tasting all the richness, all the salinity. It's really just the volume on everything has been amplified. So this is one of those wines that is very useful to have at dinner when you want to really push everybody over the edge. And wasn't that a great pairing? Wasn't that a great meal? This wine does that because Verdicchio is along the lines of Grunewald and being super food friendly with whatever else you're going to do. Sauvignon Blanc has the most acid. So now we're just taking this great marriage. And I can't, there's only
Calamari.
About 28 hectares of this in the world. That's it. So
that's like 50, not, that's like 60 acres.
There's not a lot of people. And it's all in market. It's nowhere else. No one's trying to even grow it anywhere else. It's all in market.
I mean, I can't grow it here, so it's not going to happen. But not
a lot
on
more
it.
Sandy soil needed.
Yeah, I need a lot more sandy soil. But honestly, I mean, like I was thinking calamari would do really, I mean, like there's a lot of options. Like it would do well with what you're eating. It would do well with like everything that's on our plates
yeah,
here.
It
so
can handle the freshness of green flavors, little tanginess from yogurt and other things like that.
Yeah.
I love it. And it's hard for me to find, you know, different ways to express how much I love Verdicchio. And then along comes something like this. Where I'm like,
I love
right,
Verdicchio.
Even if you're not into Verdicchio yet, you'll be into this. And then the next time we have Verdicchio, I'm going to convince you to drink that with me too.
Do they ever put this in a barrel?
No, but they're working on another white blend where they're using Incrocio Bruni with some other stuff to make a new one for it.
I could actually see this in concrete too.
Yeah, they're working on some eggs. I'll be interested to see what happens with those.
They're very. I wish I could use it. Yeah, they're expensive.
Yeah,
anyway,
they're also playing around with, you know, in this area they're doing the chestnut eggs now too. Talk about expensive! It's like driving a
what?
Porsche. Yeah, we'll talk about that another time. Anyway, so anybody, any further questions on any of the whites? Any reactions? Anybody not like them? I want to be two for two on this one. Because the rest, the reason why I want to be 2 for 2 on the whites is because everything else is red from here on out. I was expecting us to be in the throes of ridiculously cold, you know, late January, February. I didn't realize that, of course, today would be the day that it broke and we actually have warmth. So I planned doing a lot of reds and taking us on a Mr. Toad's wild ride for our palate. The second attempt that Rachel and I ever made to do the podcast.
It was the first attempt, though.
The first one with you. Second one.
Okay.
The first one where Rachel and I paired up, I said, hey, Rachel, what are you doing this afternoon? And we went down to Pizzeria DeMarco in Bethesda. Yeah. If you haven't been, go there. Phenomenal food. Unbelievable people. They have this great back room. And we had a winemaker in town from Manchuela, Spain. It's actually the highest altitude vineyards in Spain are hers. And it's an amazing story. And we sat for almost like 2 hours with Carmen just telling stories, talking back and forth about wine philosophy, about places to travel, about things to eat, what we liked about wine. It was one of the best wine conversations I've ever had in my life. And it just so happened that we were recording it. So I was super excited. And we went back at the end of it. And when it said uploading, 5 minutes later, I got this message, corrupted file. No. Can't find it. And I went back and I'm like, well, what about the automatic backup? Because I was recording it on Zoom. So at least we'll have that. Nope. The internet had kicked out at one point in time and it shut that down. So I'm going, you got to be kidding me. So my whole entire hope and wish is that we can get Carmen back and redo that.
That'd be great.
You guys see that sometime because this winery. So the winery is called Mil Historias. Sorry. Let's pour that in your glass if you have it ready. Mil Historias in Manchuela, Spain is the culmination of a lifelong dream of Rosalie La Melina and her husband, who bought this old co-op winery up in the mountains that was abandoned, basically. And they bought a small plot of land, and then they kept adding to it a little at a time, a little at a time. And she's the winemaker, and he is the viticulturist, the enologist. And every day he would go out, and he would go travel around and explore all over the mountains and everything else, and then come back and tell Rosalia over dinner what he found. And he would bring back these little buckets of dirt with him. They ended up having like 16 different soil types on their property. And imagine if we put all of our tables together on this side of the room together. They have a giant table like that in the center of the winery with glass on top and all of the different soil types right there. So you can see everything that they have. The winery is called Mil Historias for, again, hundreds of stories because that's what it was. Every time we go out, he'd find, here's an old vine Bobal vineyard. Here's old vine Tempranillo. Here's Petit Mansang. All these amazing grapes that were grown there. And Rosalia is so talented. Every time she would find something new, she's like, I wonder what I can do with that. So she's pushing the limits on how you make all the wines also. She's not afraid to make sparkling wine, to make skin contact wine, to make orange wine. She's got old vine Garnacha Blanca that she put in amphoras. She's got a white blend where she's doing Garnacha Blanca and Chardonnay and Albarino. I mean, literally, she's just like, I have this idea and I'm going to do it. But their pride and joy are these high altitude, the highest vineyards and some of the oldest vineyards in all of Spain of Bobal, which they found that were upwards of 110 years old. And the vines, when they get that old, they look like tree trunks.
They're pretty gnarly, actually.
Significant.
Yeah, I mean, like, because they're like curved. I mean, and they're not, they don't produce that much. Really, when vines get to about 30 years old, that's like their peak. It's not like they're producing the most at 30 years old. They're actually producing the most probably at 7 years old. And then once they hit 30, it's going like very slowly downhill in terms of quantity. The quality, I mean, obviously is very different. And it's a very different level of concentration that you can get in a lot of those grapes, but it's a very different quantity. You're getting 20% probably of what you would get at the year 7.
Yeah. And that's, again, 20% is your total. You're losing 30 to 70% of what you could by keeping these old vines there. But one of the best analogies I ever heard was, think like the cranky old guys from the Muppets. That's what old vines are like. They're going to do what they want. They're going to have their own opinions. You have no business whatsoever criticizing them because they're just sitting there saying, get off my lawn or come over here and deliver my pay. I mean, they're going to do what they want to do, and either you embrace it and you live up to the fact that I have no idea if I'm going to get a couple pounds of fruit or a lot of fruit.
Yeah.
But what I'm going to get, I'm going to cherish and value because there's nothing else that can replicate it. It is so different and so unique and so wildly variant and amazing.
They also have like in my perspective, great immune systems.
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you think about during COVID, like, either, you know, like, a lot of times, I, like, my grandparents, like, I mean, like, they're, like, the more weathered you are, the more strength you have. And I think in this case, for vines, it's very similar. But it's really interesting because, I mean, we have 43-year-old vines on our property, and they're not producing nearly what they should be producing, but the what they are producing is very different than what they were producing 5 years ago. I mean, the concentration is very different, and that's something that you see in, like, quote unquote old vine wines. And old vine is, like, anything that's, I think, over 20 years old can be considered.
We should talk about it. In America, yeah. They've designated, the belief is anything over 35 years
35.
Old can be called an old vine.
Yeah.
And so with that as your baseline of what old vines are, again.
Yeah. Compared to 110 years old. I mean, there's a big difference there. I mean, like, in that case, like, I mean, my vines are old vine. I should put that on my label, but, like, I won't because, like, I don't know, but
sometimes old vine means something. Sometimes it doesn't. But when you're talking, like, old vine McLaren Valley down in Australia, and we're talking 120 years old, and some of these, and centennial vines in
they're not
California.
All 100. You're replacing some.
No, some. Well, yeah. Some yes, some.
Yeah,
no.
It's just funny.
These aren't. She has two vineyards. Her young vines of Bobal are between 15 and 35 years old, and then she has her old vines. So
yeah.
She can supplant that at any point in time if needs to. Again, this is an isolated property that I found. Anybody had Bobal before tonight, out of curiosity? Okay. So Bobal is going to give, for the most part, these medium body levels as far as how big your wine is. Something that's going to be between Pinot Noir and Rhone, I think, is where most people's expectations are. I tried it and I thought, okay, I like Bobal a little bit more than Mencia, one of the other kind of oddball Spanish grapes that you don't see. But then the first time I had old vine Bobal, it changed everything for me because there's this dark, concentrated cherry core, and my liver at all levels is always screaming for something that is a less expensive version of Pinot Noir. You know, give me something that gives me that layering and that ability that I just want to plant my nose in the glass and smell it for about 15, 20 minutes before I have my first sip of it, because it's got so much involvement in there and so many different things. And that's one of those things about this Bobal that I love. Every time I smell it, I get a different flavor.
So what I would recommend is when you're smelling it, like, when you smell into a glass, it's usually like for a fraction of a second. Like, actually let your nose smell it for like a full one Mississippi, because from there you get this level of spice that is so interesting. You don't get that from the first like quarter Mississippi. It's like from one Mississippi entirely. And then you get mulling spice, you get cinnamon, you get that black pepper, you get all of those like really herbal characteristics that you wouldn't have gotten in the initial. I went back to it a few times and I was thinking, wait a second, there's something there. So I went one full Mississippi and it totally hit. And it's...
I get mint and tar and tea. And
tea, the black, the black, like,
get very
like breakfast
specific,
tea.
Like if you... It's not just like cracked pepper. It's like when you take peppercorns and like put them between two plates to crack them so that you have that really.
That's how I cook those. So that's why it's black. That's why black pepper.
It's just it's a really cool wine, but there's still, with all that and all those layers and all those spices, there's a drinkability to it. There's a drinkability I love that is not on a learning curve. Again, one of my big issues with a lot of wine geek grapes that people go out there is they're made for a very limited number of palates, or you have to love Chenin that's been aged from a horse's shoe, and if you don't have that, then you're not going to get it. But maybe one day you'll get it. I'm like, no, I bought a bottle of wine, I should want to drink it. And that's what this does. This gives me that more concentration and everything else. But this is another one that, for all its intensity and everything else, I don't see any problems with polishing off a bottle of this. It's not like one of those things that I need to switch up to another bottle of wine. I'm not going to change when I'm drinking this until the bottle is empty.
It gives you something different every time you try it, I think, which is really nice. And the nose is slightly different than the palate in the sense of the spice is totally on the nose. You don't get as much of the spice on the palate, but you get actually almost a level of borderline creaminess on the palate, which I think is a good juxtaposition because it keeps you interested and it keeps you wanting to like, okay, wait, let me see if there's something else in there that I'm missing. And it's every sip is totally different.
And I'm going to hit that T-ball out of the park here, because to me, part of that is because this is an unfiltered and unfined wine.
Yeah.
So anytime you have those unfiltered, unfined wines, when they develop and they're made well,
they offer those little surprise packages whenever you're opening up a bottle and smelling them. It's always going to be pretty consistent as far as the flavor and the expectation, but there are just times when it takes this little left turn, and it's like talking to one of your best friends, and then you cock your head like, I never knew that about you before. I've known you for like 20 years, and I didn't expect that. And that's, you know, why I love the regular version of this wine. Is about like $16, $17 a bottle, and it's super fresh and super fruity and super light. So it just doesn't have that baking spice quality to it and everything else, but it also doesn't have that weight. Like, again, as I sit here, the way that white wine really dried out your palate, the more you sit without sipping this wine, the more that gum line starts to come into play, where you're kind of like chewing on your lips just a little bit, whether you notice it or not, because you're thinking that, man, maybe I could have another little bite to eat. Maybe I could have something with a little fat or a little meat to it, or maybe just another sip of the wine.
It's really interesting, you know, when you learn about wine, and that's what I think is so much different than what we're seeing in like the news these days about alcohol, because there's lots of controversial things, even though if you go into the studies, it's very different. If you go to read the studies, it's actually very different than what they're saying is the headlines. Wine is a very much part of culture, but it's also very much an ever-evolving product. What you have in the bottle, once as soon as it's bottled, is very different on a weekly basis until you open it and drink it. I mean, that's why a lot of times you see a bottle of wine that it says like from a vintage like 3 years prior, they might have only been barrel aging it for maybe a year. And it was sitting in a bottle for a year and a half before they even released it. It was because of things like this that you're seeing an evolution. Even as it's sitting in the glass, you're seeing an evolution as you smell it, the one Mississippi aspect. It's a really interesting way of learning about different flavors and different chemical compounds that are natural. Because like you don't get that from manipulation. You get that from the true expression of the variety. And I think that there's a lot to say about the wine industry as like these producers that we've had so far. I mean, you're having like eco-sustainable. Mill Historias is also natural, right? I'm doing it in quotations because like even conventional wines are technically kind of natural because you can't, even if you add yeast, it's still like 80% of a natural fermentation because you can't really, anyway, it's a whole thing. But there's a lot of points to be said about how it's a living being in many aspects. I mean, like that's why you say wine is over the hill, or wine is in its prime, or like, oh, you should wait 5 years because it's like a wild teenager and it's going to get to be its young adult phase where like all of a sudden it's like realize what its life is going to be like. There's a lot of life that has to do with what we're drinking, and how it pairs is based off of what we're like at that moment. It's a really unique product. I mean, obviously that's why I'm in the industry, but I just wanted to kind of mention that like this wine has been evolving as we've been tasting it compared to the other one that's like the other Bobal. It's like they're meant for very specific methods. Yeah. So
drink me now.
But yeah. At least three more years.
I'd be even more generous than Rachel on that one. This is one of those ones that I'd be putting up in my 5 to 15 year range where I want to see what it's like in 10 years. I drank as recently as last year, some 2011 of this.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, see, I haven't had that. Had that invite.
It's a little more plummy. Like,
let's be honest.
One day we'll do old stuff.
Okay.
It's a little more of that cooked fruit, prunes, and plum aspect, that little balance between acid and richness. But it's one of those things that it still has the acidity. It still has that floral aspect to it. And those baking spices aren't going away. As Rachel said, it color-wise, no bricking at all. So when you turn it off to the side, like if you still have any of this wine in your glass, you notice this deep, intense violet color that it has. And the one that was 4 years older than this was still not showing any
really
change on rim variation, none at all.
Okay, if you told me that, I would have said 5 years. But like, yeah, it's okay. I was thinking 3 years because I think 3 years is it's probably at its prime in 3 years. 5 years is like when you're like enjoying its maturity.
So. Again, I don't have any thought that it's going to last for 5 years. And in 5 years, I'll be able to drink another bottle and tell you, you know, if I think it's going to go on more than that. But right now, think of wines like a bell curve. You know, we're still going on the up. We're not cresting yet where we're going to be on the downside where you're looking at a limited amount of time you have it. Right now, this is one of the things that I throw in my cellar. And anytime I have, you know, somebody that, you know, wants to try something different, or again, that in between, or if you're not in the mood for, you know, something light and soft, and you're not in the mood for something big and heavy, this fits for all occasions. Chuela in the Pyrenees Mountains. So way, way high up there on the border with France. It is lovely to take pictures of. You can go to the website for Emil Historias.
you'll see the vineyards and snow and the mountains and everything else beside them. It is amazingly stunning. And again, I can't wax poetic about how nice these people are and how excited I am to have them in our portfolio, and hope they keep finding more and more land. She makes an ice wine from 120-year-old Petit Mansang vines. Petit Mansang, a French grape that just made it up the mountain, and then just nobody knew what to do with it. And then they found it, and she makes it into real live ice wine. Cool. With global warming, you can't find a lot of ice wine because it's just the weather is not right. In Spain, they have to freeze the grapes for 48 hours naturally. And then an inspector has to come and look at your grapes and say, yep, that's frozen. Okay, now you can go make it. So imagine a winemaker who is like, yay, I can make ice wine. And now I've got to wait for some guy to tell me it's frozen. And you're hoping that the weather doesn't change so you can still do that. So it's an amazing thing. Does anybody need to take a little break, a bathroom break or anything else before we push on to part two of the... No? Everybody good? All right. Well, then I guess part two, we push on. Staying with our high altitude theme, our next winery, we are going to move from the mountains of Spain over to the mountains of Italy to a winery called La Crata di Vigneron, whose wine cellars are 78 meters up. Out there, their door, you can see Mount Blanc, and they are actually on the Matterhorn also. It is crazy.
It's amazing.
It's breathtaking.
Yeah.
And the wines that they do are really fun because they're playing around with some Pinot Noir. They've got some Chambord. They've got a little Chasselas that's around there. They've got Prix Blanc and Muscat. Gewurztraminer is showing up every once in a while too. Then they have some other grapes. Again, because of their proximity to Switzerland, this is a whole trade route area. So you found this influx of Swiss, French, and Italian influences in everything they do. And along comes this grape that's in your glass right now called Phu Minh. Phu Minh can trace one of its lineage to an ancient grape called Cornelin, but the other half they can't find out. They just don't know. Even with all the DNA tests and everything else, they can't figure out what the other half is. There is some belief because some of the markers, genetic markers, make it look like it's related to Syrah in some way, shape, or form. Or maybe it's related to another grape up there called Houmon Rouge. But they just can't figure out that other half of it. And they just don't know what it is. But if you think to the mountains and where they are, we're talking that area, you know, St. Bernards and little liquor barrels on their collars and everything else, where it's going to get cold and windy and snowy and everything else. The sun, when it's out, is amazing and it ripens everything else. But when it gets cold, it gets cold. And when it gets cold, raclette, stews, you know, stuff that's cooked in a big cast iron pot.
Yeah, it was like a rice soup that was really risotto. But like they said, rice soup with venison. It was amazing. Yeah.
And there's a little rustic aspect to it.
Yeah, I mean, it actually kind of has a Switzerland feel when you're there.
Well, yeah.
Well, because we were there.
You might as well be Heidi if you could have braids.
Well, LOL. My braids. I really miss this wine. I mean, I first tried it, and what was it? It was 2017, and it was a really cool experience because this winery is actually a cooperative, and it's a conglomerate of like what 40 other. This is all my brain remembering. Yep. Was it 40 something?
Yep. Yeah, 40 plus.
Wow. Yeah, so 40 plus like other vineyards in the area. They really care about what they do. It's not like a hoity-toity, like you walk into the winery and it's like, you know, looks like a mansion.
It's not fancy.
It's not fancy.
It looks a little bit like if you recall those old Swiss chalet stores in the malls with the white and the beams and everything else like that.
But like, I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, it's a really beautiful location. And Phu Minh was a really interesting variety because it has a lot of this like plump, dark fruit, but it has a little bit of that smoke. It has a little bit of that pepper, but it was, with venison, it was fantastic. It was actually the first time I ever had venison. I will never forget that meal because it was the first time I had venison and it called a rice soup, but it was really risotto. And I sat next to the winemaker and he just was like, so it tastes good, right? I said, yeah. I said, of course it does. And he goes, so you like venison? I said, I had no idea that I was eating venison, but I guess I do. I mean, it was one of those situations that was, it was actually during that whole trip that I was somehow sat next to every single winemaker. I don't know why, but I just sat down and they're like, okay, we're sitting next to you. But Phu Minh was a really interesting variety because it was a flavor profile that I hadn't really tried before as having been in the industry. I mean, it was something that you can imagine wine to taste like, but I don't think you imagine a wine to, when you actually taste it, to taste like that. And like, it's kind of like one of those cartoon wines in my perspective. Like,
absolutely.
Like when you bite into a chicken leg and you like think of a chicken leg, you think of it like a cartoon. Like, you know, you think of that whole like way that they eat it. I think of red wine sometimes tasting like this, but it's actually for real life. And so it was a really interesting experience, if that makes sense.
No, I get it, because I'm over here just my brain is overloading, because I don't know what you guys get when you smell this wine, but for me it's dark roasted fruits, campfire, licorice, and birch syrup. You know, like that birch beer type spice to it.
I get a lot of boysenberry.
Wild to me that you find all these things. I always have loved, as much as I like your layered and perfumey Pinot Noirs, I don't mind knife and fork wines at all. If you give me something that's chewy and smoky and campfire-y, I'm always going to be interested by that. Let's see where you go. Do you have the fruit to pull it off? Do you have the spice in the mid palate? Is there balance? Does the whole thing fall apart and taste like Smucker's jam, or is there something going on? And this one, yeah, I'm all about stews and pot roasts and everything. I'm like, this is a winter wine in every way, shape, and form. You know, go start a fire, sit outside when it's cold, we'll go inside or jump in the hot tub and bring a bottle of this. It's just one of those things that this is a really rustic and rugged, again, unfiltered, unfined from high altitude vineyards, you know, 4,000 meters up. Take that, California.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Dude, I could go on for days about that, but.
And chili night. Bring this to your next chili night, your next chili cook-off when everybody in there was having chili.
Short ribs. I mean, like. Ribs,
short ribs are great with this.
Like
short ribs with those little caramelized onions and everything else, where it's just.
Or just ribs in a smoker, like with that, like with the barbecue sauce. But I mean, I have to say, like the venison, I always remember venison from this.
No, venison, elk, any game meats, yeah. Rabbit galore.
Yeah, rabbit would do well. Right. Duck would do well.
Yeah, it's Chinese New Year, so you need a wine for Lunar New Year? Here you go. Here's your duck wine. Any amount of hoisin or anything else, or black trumpet or mushrooms that you're going to stuff it with, this wine would do great with that.
100, yeah.
Also, the next wine would do great with duck. In fact, you know, one of my all-time favorite pairings is to tell people, if you're having Pinot Noir, there are three things that should show up in your brain, and that is duck, tuna, and mushrooms. And without a doubt, if you just want to look at what's the easy thing to do, those are the things that Pinot Noir was made for, all those things. Not the magic ones.
I feel like those, but not the other.
It's so what the reason mushrooms are, because mushrooms have that earthy umami, that combination of again, whether you're talking oyster mushrooms, king mushrooms, trumpeter, black four, I mean, there's so many different variations, and they all have that little bit of warmth on the back end and that little bit of forest undergrowth. And again, it's a question of how intense it is. I know when I was a kid, you couldn't get me to eat a mushroom. I'm like, I saw one of those grow out of the dog's thing that they left for us. No, I'm not gonna.
Have you had a mushroom pancetta risotto? That's why you don't like mushrooms. It's like, it's the gateway. It's the gateway. I made it myself and other places too, but also to other places too. But I mean, like, it's a, but that to me was like, that's what got me into eating mushrooms, because I mean, bacon fat or any, like pancetta with, it's like the same thing with Brussels sprouts. I mean, like, that's your gateway. It's the gateway. Yeah.
So again, we're not talking about Pinot Noir though. We have moved down to Sicily here. This is Palmetto Costanzo's Nero di Sé, a beautiful, beautiful wine from Mount Etna, the only other area that can rival Tuscany as far as what everybody has been talking about for the last 30-some-odd years. And there are, again, Super Tuscan has been great, but right behind it, everybody has been talking about the volcanic wines from that side of the island, from Mount Etna in Sicily. If you haven't looked at Mount Etna lately, I encourage you to go online and look at some of the live cameras. The Italian volcanoes and the one in Hawaii are putting on quite a show right now. And the images from space are pretty cool too, because you've got all these white clouds around it, and then magma, lava popping up through the clouds. This winery is an old 5th century Palmetto, a 5th century winemaking area. I mean, one of the fun rules that Sicily has is that no existing building is allowed to be destroyed. Anything that is there, if you're going to build on it, you have to incorporate whatever is there into your building.
That's
so
cool.
This was a dream to restore this old 5th century building up to modern days. And they built one of the most glorious wineries I've ever seen. It's a mother and daughter team. Mom has this timeless kind of Katharine Hepburn, Betty Davis beauty to her. She is stunningly gorgeous. Her daughter has this Hollywood Jamie Gertz dark hair type thing, pale skin going on. And they're making these incredible wines, and the way they talk about them with such passion and love, you get that this has been a family dream forever. The winery is 100% gravity fed. They bring the wines in up top at the top of the hill where they're then sorted. And then all the way, every single process that it moves through, there are no machines. It's all just naturally moving from sorting table into the press and then down into the tanks and then down into the aging barrels. And again, I will walk around and I'll show you a picture of it. It's one of the most gorgeous things I've ever seen. And the reason why they didn't want to do a lot of manipulation is because they're dealing with Nerella Mascalese and Nerella Cappuccia, two wines, two grape varietals that in the United States came to prominence in the early 2000s when Mark DeGrazia and his brother famously had a wine distribution, very successful wine distribution effort nationally in the United States, went back to Sicily, their homeland, and bought some land on Mount Etna. And everybody was like, what are you doing down there? Sicily still was looked at mostly as jug wine for the most part and not doing anything of real interest or significance. But they knew from their family and their relatives that, you know, the people at Kos and a little woman named Ariane Occhipinti was really pushing the level of it. And they thought, look, we've seen the Burgundy market. And we know that we can grow grapes that rival Burgundy on Mount Etna from international varietals. And, you know, their pre-philosopher at the time was like $75. And it was unheard of to have a $75 bottle of Sicilian wine. Now I think that bottle is $230-some-odd for that same stuff, if you can find it. We spent 6 years looking for a Sicilian winery. And in the middle of COVID, we were sent samples from this winery. They said, look, we'd like you to try something. We sent you a box of wine. And it's December 17th. It's about 13 degrees outside, and we're all in coats with our big warehouse door open, put a plastic table out there. We put all the wines out there, and 12 of us are all sitting in winter coats.
Why didn't you go to the loft area, the upstairs?
Because they didn't want to. Nobody wanted it. Everybody's like, nope, we got to have airflow and everything outside.
Oh, right.
So here we are freezing our butts off, and I try this, and I'm knocked sideways by how delicious and how amazing this wine is. Even in those frigid temperatures, there was something special about this. And it started just with looking at it in the glass. This is one of the prettiest wine. This is, for me, if we're not talking a big punch you in the throat, chip your teeth red wine, this is what I want my red wines to look like. There's a shimmer to it. There's a brightness. This is the thing that, you know, I was born in July, so ruby is the gemstone. This is the thing that, you know, really good rubies should look like. It's all of this color, all of this shimmer, all this glitter.
I mean, it has a look between like Pinot Noir and Nebbiolo. But
what do you think about the tannins, though?
Tannins are beautiful.
Right?
I mean, they're strong, but they're subtle at the same time because they don't hit like every point of your mouth. They don't take out too much water out of your mouth. There's a little bit of fruit there. I mean, that's a good question.
This is 2018. So this is 7 years old already. And again, when we were talking before about bricking and everything else, you turn this off to the side. There's some slight little discoloration around the edge, but not a whole lot. This is still a baby. Little teeny tiny baby like Burgundy that's going to last 25 years without even trying.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that this wine is just going to go on and on and on and on forever. To me, I love it. I love that dryness and that dark flavor in the center. That's volcanic soils. When you look at the soils that these vines are growing, they are black like coffee grounds. We're not even talking hummus or anything else here. We're talking black lava and ash. And because the volcano is always active, it keeps refreshing those volcanic characteristics that will make these wines have that dynamite, beautiful taste. Drainage, when we were talking about soil.
But they're all drainage.
Here's rain.
Yeah.
So your vines have this great balance between struggling and getting what they need. And so your vines struggle because they had that water. They force all their vines to go very, very deep in the soil to keep finding it. And so then they become self-sustaining no matter what the weather is. And
yeah,
as long as it's not an oven, you know, you make
it's really beautiful. I mean, it's like the Sicilian version of Barolo or Barbaresco, because Barbaresco is a little bit more elegant in some aspects.
But
sometimes
that spice is there.
Yeah, it's really pretty.
For me, I'm going to tell you that I wasn't sure if I could pull this off because we're moving from something that is such a big, chunky, chewy wine with all that licorice notes in the Fumin. But when I tried this,
the
I was like, no, wise. You know what? It's the Fumin can't come after this because the tannins in this wine they're grab your attention, but they grab your palate and they hold on to you. So that's that's what it was. The 2017 Fumin versus the 2018 on this one. It was just this one had to come next.
What? Wait, what vintage is the Fumin?
Fumin's 2017.
Oh,
yeah.
Is that color on a 2017? That's wild.
Oh no, Rachel, I'm wrong.
That's a what?
2020.
Yeah, I was gonna say. There's no way.
2017 is what I had at home. My bad. All right. I want to talk about the last wine, I guess, then. Well, we don't have to move along. I can stop. I can take a break. I'll come visit and I'll be social. Hey, Mike, how's retirement? all right, so if I stopped everybody at this moment and said right now of all the wines that we had, was there anything that everybody, you know, was most surprised about? I don't even want to get into like the most or whatever. Was there anything that you tried that you're like, wow, that was just really different or unique, and I've never had anything like that before? Or are we all pretty much just, nah, drink it. The bubbles? The Willig. Yeah.
The
well,
mead.
Yeah, I would hope that mead would be a little.
It's surprising, right?
But that's
what mead should taste like.
That's one of those things where this is why we need more bees, so Rachel can make more stuff like that.
Yeah, seriously. I do need more honey.
What about you guys? Any thoughts? That's okay. We have one. So you don't have to decide it because we're going to taste that still one first from Lugano, and then you can decide what you really like. Again, Harunda is one of those things that all day. It should be in the
evening.
Again, I wanted to go just off the pathway from familiar, but just enough. A few years ago, we started bringing in wines from one of the oldest family wineries in Canale, which is this great little mountain town in Piemonte, and it is Manchero Carbone. Carbone, like the legendary Carbone restaurant where everybody wants a table forever and ever and ever. Manchero Carbone, the current head of the winery is Francesco Manchero. He is the just elected head of the Lange Wine Trade Association. So everybody in the Lange, one of the biggest regions in Piedmont for wine, has said, we want you to lead us into the future. And they said this because of everything he did in his previous, which he still has this title also, which was the head of the Arnais Consortium. Arnais at one point in time had less than 60 hectares left in the world and was a grape that was very important to a few farmers in the Piedmont region, but was destined to be ripped out in favor of other things as they were going through and trying to plant other grapes and make more money. And a few people just said, no, we can't let this happen. We can't let this grape die out. His family had been very, very involved in Arnais, and even in looking at the history of Arnais and trying to figure out the DNA and the genetics behind it. The winery started in the 1900s or early on. It was one of the first female-owned wine properties in all of Italy. And if you think of how male, patriarchal, dominated Northern Italy is, to say that in 1907,
that's wild.
A woman in Northern Italy was becoming one of the first landed females.
Actually, was that because of the Austro-Hungarian Empire?
No, it was because her husband went off to war and then went off to New York for 3 years and she didn't hear from him. And she was an older woman in her 30s. And she was very, very uncomfortable already about the fact. At the time, older woman in her 30s with no husband around, even though, yeah, I'm sure you have a husband. So you can imagine the village voices of everybody saying everything. And so here she is saying, I don't like this. I am uncomfortable. So very much behind the scenes, Clotilde Valente went off and started to make inquiries into buying land and had some other friends that would buy it in their name and then transfer the deed to her. And then her husband comes back and it's like, I love you. I love you still. Are you going away again? No, you're not. Okay, you can come inside. And one day he's sitting and he says, honey, I was thinking we should do something with a dowry. And she says, I have an idea. He said, what do you want to do, honey? We should start a winery and a vineyard. Honey, it takes a lot of land to start a winery. It's a nice thought. To which she goes, honey, we might own a lot of land since you've been gone. And shocked is her husband to find out that they are the owners of Montbrion, this legendary hilltop vineyard that was carved out by the glaciers and leaving behind some of the most sandy, rich soil that you find anywhere. When you look at aerial photos of it, it almost looks white as you're looking down between the vines and everything else because of the high level of sand that's there. Which again, the vines can thrive in that and then push down and find all their other sources. And it was ideal for growing Arnais and Nebbiolo. And then another grape that they thought,
you know, at one point in time that Arnaise was maybe the parent grape of Nebbiolo. But then there was also a red version, Red Roero.
Like I hadn't had that before this.
And that's what's in your glass, Red Roero. It is not the parent of Nebbiolo. It's one of those distant cousins that is related.
The clusters look very much
like Nebbiolo clusters, but it's a darker skin to it. So you can do a little bit more skin contact. The rules around Roero like this are not the same as Barolo. So what they've decided to do is change the aging process. To do Barolo, you've got to basically sell your soul to lose 30% of your wine while it's sitting in oak for 2.5 to 3.5 years.
Yep.
So this, they do about half the aging on that, which is why you get this darker, deeper color to it. But it's also why there's more of an explosion of spice and not just tannins in this. So this is for anybody that is a Barolo fan, you know, wants to drink their Barolos young. I give you Trinity from Mancero Carbon.
Honestly, the label looks pretty Spanish. Actually,
like Rota, doesn't it?
It almost? Actually looks like a like Reserva, like Spanish. I was surprised to see that it looked so Italian. It didn't look Italian. It looked so Spanish compared to it being Italian.
It's from the crazy, crazy good 2019 vintage.
Yeah.
Which, if anybody's following along, 2019 Barolos and Brunellos are looked at like blue chip stocks and are going to be talked about and traded and waxed poetic for the next 50 plus some odd years, where everybody's going to talk about, you know, did you drink them? Have you ever had them? The label, it has the traditional symbol of the family winery, which is the lion's head door knocker.
Which is a very, like, that's like a, it's a, lion is a very big show of strength.
Absolutely.
In most of Europe. I mean, like, you go to any city in any country of Europe and you see a lion, it's kind of what's the term? It's a
well, it it's was like a symbol, it's like of a, royalty and regal.
Yeah, but also like a coat of arms in some aspects.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this family symbol, I'm not going to butcher the Italian phrase that goes behind it, but basically on every door in the family winery, they have these lion door knockers and the family inscription, which basically says behind each door is possibility.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing. They're this unbelievable family. They have this gorgeous, gorgeous property. And they make stunning Arnaise, stunning Barolo. And later this year, they just acquired property and they will release their first Barbaresco and then a brand new single vineyard Barolo also. I am over the moon for these guys. But what I love about this is here is this crazy, intense, shouldn't even really be drinking it yet 2019. And yet because of the way that they age this differently, I think it's approachable. And it's one of those things that, again, I don't see any problems drinking this over the next 8+ years, or anytime you pop it open, it's just going to over deliver to you. And after that, if you can keep yourself from drinking it, it'll keep on going. But I thought this was a really cool way to bring everything new. Always needs to have that 1 foot kind of dragging in your history of knowing where you've been. And I think, Rachel, you can attest to that everybody that came before you has a pronounced effect on what you can do to create something new and special.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, like, all these wines have a very unique story and unique history. I mean, that's pretty awesome. This is really pretty.
Doesn't suck.
It's pretty awesome.
You can quote me on that.
It doesn't suck?
Doesn't suck is probably one of our highest compliments for something. We invite anybody else to challenge us on that.
So actually on Saturday, Nick was at my blending workshop at my winery, and there was a customer that said something that when we were doing the blending workshop, would you buy a glass of it at a restaurant? And that was their threshold. I want like 5 bottles of this.
Yeah.
So like, I think there's a threshold of thinking like, would you, when you're tasting the wines tonight, would you want to have a glass of it? Would you want to have a bottle of it? Would you want to have multiple bottles of it? In that sense of like, would you want to see the evolution of it? And I think that's a really interesting thought process because of like, for me, when I'm tasting wines and I'm trying wines and I'm making wine, I don't think about, do I want to have a glass of it? I think about like more than that. But to think that people think about, would I want to have a glass of it at a restaurant? What food are you going to have with it? Like, that wine entirely
venison.
Yeah, well, fumi and venison, this one lots of other stuff.
I couldn't agree with you more. I want, part of the reason when we curated this is I want you guys to not
I appreciate so much that the trust that you all put in us to invite you to come over and drink some stuff and hope that it doesn't suck. Yeah. But also the fact that, you know, we're going to push some of the limits on what you've had and what you haven't had before. But more than anything else, I want to put stuff in front of everybody that it doesn't matter when you drink it. It doesn't matter when you open it. I don't love the wines. So when we go barrel sampling and everything else that are going to be released in a couple of years and that I can be excited and say, oh, my God, wait till the 2021s are going to start to come out. You're not going to believe them. The 2023s, you know, are really good too. But when we sit down and actually drink, I want to stock my cellar with all stuff that whenever I want to drink it, I can just go and open it. I want to open it because I want to share it with somebody else that might like that grape. I want to share that story of it with somebody else, or I'm just in the mood for it. Like all of our reds tonight, I think can span the seasons quite really well, but really right now is when I want to drink all these ones. When it's a little cold and chilly outside and I'm done with the day's news or whatever stressing me out or whatever, I'm going to find solace in popping open one of these, knowing that when I open it up, it's going to be great. Whether I have a dinner in mind that I want to cook or if I'm going to figure it out afterwards, but depending on how the wine is breathing today. But when you've got unfiltered, unfined, like the Fu Min, like the Beauval, you know, you can do that. You can just say, look, I know the wine is going to be great. What do I have in the cabinets? All right, I'm going to open it up, have a little glass of it, and then I'll go figure out what I'm in the mood for at the store and everything else. But the wine's going to deliver. No matter when you choose to enjoy it, if you're going to make the investment in a bottle of wine, there's nothing worse than the wine not showing up for you. You just wasted all your money by waiting too long to drink that bottle of wine. So here is something that, this will hold for forever. But so what? If we don't wait forever, if you never get to drink it, that's no fun. So buy it, drink it whenever you want, whether it be next week, whether it be in 3 years, whether you're holding on to three or four bottles to see if it's going to really live 25 years, like Nick said. But it's a pretty cool ride to wait it out and try to figure it out.
I think the cool thing is, like, I think a couple people said they had Beauval before, but beyond that, like, how many of you have actually tried any of, like, these varieties before? Probably not. I mean, some of these were new to me, honestly. Like the last couple, like I'd say three of them were new to me in the sense of the first time trying them in either many years or just in general. And I think that that's a really cool thing to have. It doesn't matter what the variety is. I think that Cabernet Sauvignon in many aspects can be very boring. Like Chardonnay can be very boring. Like, you know what you're going to get from it. If you like it, that's great. I mean, like, I grow it. I work with it. I mean, I don't grow Chardonnay. I work with it. Be honest here. I work with it, but I think that there's a lot of aspects of working with varieties and drinking varieties that you like because you like them. It doesn't matter who they are, what they are. It matters more so that you enjoy them, that they have a story, that they're something that you resonate with. And you can remember them as like, okay, I had this one bottle of Barolo and it reminded me of a Barolo, but different. And so you're going to open a bottle of it and you're going to tell a friend exactly what it's like because of that aspect. It's like an Italian Barolo, but not. I don't know. I think it's a very interesting concept of drinking varieties that you don't always see in the store, because that is what wine is. There's over 8,000 different varieties. And if you're sticking with two or three, you're really not enjoying every part about wine. And every story that you could actually learn and understand. I don't know. It's just a big thing of who I
And there's
who
another
I
benefit
believe in.
Too.
Yeah.
Because we all have that. I mean, you guys are here because you drink wine. Or because somebody dragged you here and said, come on, let's go. But either way, we all have that one friend that knows everything about wine. Everything. Oh, yeah, that's nice. But I remember you were there for this. We had a great mutual friend. That was a phenomenal wine drinker, an amazing, amazing individual, one of my favorite people on the planet. But he had the balls to say to an Italian winemaker that was visiting, oh, that's a nice wine, but that's no Brunello. Hold on, why don't I go home and get one of my bottles of wine? This guy that is that, like, really, he's brought all of his stuff over. He's not speaking very English very well, but he's understanding that this guy just said, your wine is not as good as what I have at home. And so he told this gentleman, go ahead. But it wasn't one of those, go ahead, I'm looking forward to this. It was like, let's go. And the guy went home, got a bottle of wine, and then the winemaker told him exactly what he thought about it. This was a pinky.
Yeah, I figured that.
I'll tell you later.
Yeah.
But it was still one of those things.
That's awesome. That
he was very excited to show this winemaker his favorite wine, even if it didn't come off in the right way. And the winemaker was even more excited when he told me, Nick, open that other bottle. Because I had an older vintage of one of his bottles of wine that we weren't showing because we said, look, this is like a little Friday happy hour tasting. We're not opening up $60 bottles of wine. But okay, he started it. So we pulled out his, what he literally made as a wine to shut the Italians up. So if an Italian is telling you, I'm making something to shut my countrymen up, you should listen because there's a lot of intent behind that. And we opened up this beautiful Super Tuscan. That made this other guy go, well, why didn't you just give me that first? Because he had nothing to say when he tried that wine. Because it was clearly better than the thing that he prized. But that's the thing. You can share wine with everybody. You can have a fun time. And then you can sometimes grab for your Barolo friend that is talking about, I have this great bottle of wine. I baby it everything up. Printy, shut up. And there's something fun about turning on your friends to new wines. There's something really great about sharing great wines with other people that appreciate it. And to me, if you make that, you know, like Rachel said, with the mushrooms, when you have that dish and it's in your head, and then you're able to recreate that taste memory by going off and finding another great bottle of wine and making that dish again, that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about, because no matter what the world is blowing up and doing, you just had this wonderful little moment right there. I had some really good food.
Yeah.
I had a really good drink. I forgot about everything else that was going on, and I've got at least, you know, 500 more milliliters to make me forget a little bit more. You guys, cheers to all of you.
Thanks for coming out once again.
Thank you.